Well, hello again, everyone, and welcome to the third teleclass in our series on CBIC and CIC certification. Today we have the examination process, computer-based testing. My name is Paul Weber, and it is an honor to host this teleclass with two of my favorite people. There are actually three names on the title slide because there were three people who helped put the slides together. But there are two people presenting today's teleclass, Sheila McDonald and Sharon Christofiak. Both of these ladies are very experienced ICPs. Both have been a part of the Certification Board in Infection Control for a very long time. Sheila has been the CBIC president as well as the president of CHICA Canada. Sharon is the president-elect for 2009, and she'll be president in 2009. And she is the 2008 chair of the Strategic Planning Committee. Both are extremely well qualified to cover this material, so I will let them get started. Sharon will go first, and Sheila will pick it up partway through. So to get us started on the teleclass, the examination process, computer-based testing, Sharon Christofiak. Sharon.
Greetings, everyone. This is, as Paul said, our third part of this series on the certification process. And what we wanted to feature today was a little bit more about, now that you know how to study, you know how you take tests, you may want to know, what do I do next? So we're going to try and go through the process of what you'll be doing for the next steps. So if you start with our second slide, the objectives, what we want to do today for you is to review the process of taking the computer-based exam. Most of our CBT, computer-based testing, is done by, obviously, computer. There are certain things you need to know just to lower the stress level for when you're getting ready to do this, and how do you even get to the center to begin with. We want to talk about points on the application specific for the international candidates. There are some differences if you're listening from the United States or any other country. We want to advise examinees about the structure of the exam questions and the answer options. So just some of the things that you need to know before we really get you out the door. Next slide. This is one of the things that Marge wanted to contribute to the lecture today. And we've all heard things you've told to Paul, things you've told to us. You had really hoped in this teleclass series that would be able to tell you exactly what the questions are on the exam, or how should I study, or what should I look at. Unfortunately, we can't tell you, even though we have been on the certification board now for 4 or 5 years. This is something that we take an oath of honor every meeting we come to, that we are not providing education on what's on the exam. It wouldn't be fair to anybody if you could listen to one teleclass or go to an APIC certification preparation course to the other people that hadn't spent the money to go to these particular lessons. So it's something that we're very strict about doing. We can give you clues, we can tell you how to study, but we can't tell you what's on the test. So I hope everybody can appreciate that. Next slide, please. The computer-based exam. Anytime you're beginning your certification process, that first exam is always the high security computer-based exam. As you've heard in our previous teleclasses, we are NCCA certified, which is a very high standard for testing. We have to make sure that the right person that's getting the certificate is actually the person showing up for the test, so this is why it's a proctored exam. The recertification exam, for anybody who's already certified and needs to recertify, is paper-based at this time. This is something that can be mailed out, worked at on your leisure. It's an open book type of test. And this particular exam is approved for recertification, but not for that original credentialing. Technology to mark a paper-based exam is becoming extinct. Unfortunately, I can remember getting through high school and having to take a pen and pencil type of paper and pencil exam to get into college. This has been quite a long time now, and the paper system is just not something that's able to be supported anymore. The machines that actually read those little black pencil marks are no longer being serviced, or available. So in the future, the SARE, the Self-Assessment Recertification Exam, is going to have to be computer-based also. And at this time, we believe that'll start the middle of next year, 2009. Next slide. So you've finally decided, you've heard us talking about it, you've learned how to study, etc. You're ready to write the exam, or at least you're thinking about it. First of all, next slide, what you really need to do is become very familiar with the CIBIC handbook. As Sheila has said in her slide, it's a goldmine of information. Virtually everything you need to know is in the candidate handbook. You can either download it from the website and print it out on your home printer, or just look at it online at www.cibic.org. You may also request that we'll mail you a hard copy in case you want the nice little book that you can walk around with. It looks a little nicer sometimes. Make sure you read it very carefully because there are a lot of helpful tidbits in there. Next slide. The application process, there are actually two ways to apply to take the exam itself. The hard copy method, you can fill in an application. It's available in the candidate handbook you receive through the mail, but you can also do it where you download it from the website and print out a hard copy, fill that in. You would mail that in to the AMP organization, all of which is online or in the candidate handbook, and you'll receive notification on your eligibility to test. You'll also make an appointment so that within 90 days, you'll be able to go to a test center once you receive your eligibility certificate to write from the CBIC AMP folks. You can choose the time of year to take the test. I know we've heard from several American candidates that they try to go to the H&R Block centers where we offer our American testing during the first few weeks of April. Well, that's past us. But when you think about H&R Block in the United States, they're very active as tax time comes around. So you can schedule it at your convenience, and you may want to think about something like this if you're not quite ready at this time to even take the exam. Next slide. For the U.S. applicants, there's also an online application process, and we'll kind of walk you through some of the screenshots. It actually takes you to the AMP, Applied Measurement Professionals Incorporated, which is our management and testing company. Those of us on the CBIC board are actually volunteers. We're all ICPs. But we have a company that actually does the hard work for us, putting the information online, the security, all the processing of fees, et cetera. So what you would do is go to the www.goamp.com website. There is a link from the CBIC website that you can go directly there. Next slide. Once you've picked your test site that you want to take it in, you will get a calendar, and you can actually pick, do you want an AM or PM session, what day of the week, what day you want to go totally. So we feel that it's probably a lot more convenient than the old paper and paper pencil testing that we used to offer, where it was maybe only offered once every 6 months at different locations. Next slide. When you get through the information that you need to put in, it will give you a final check. This is what you want. The CIC exam, you want it in Orlando on a particular date, etc., and then you would hit the continue button. When you do that, you've scheduled your appointment. I'm sure you're all familiar with any of these online application type things where you can actually hit the enter key and submit. It will give you a confirmation, gives you a confirmation number. Please print the screen for your records. This is something that's very helpful. You're going to need to take this with you to the test site just to prove that you've registered online should there be an issue. Next slide. So, scheduling summary. The application process is very similar if you have to do this via a paper method where you're sending it if you're an international candidate. You do have the scheduling options. You can do this by phone or by web. You should schedule at least 3 days in advance of your test date after you've selected whenever you want to go, wherever you want to actually show up in person. There is rescheduling possible. Should something have to change your time. You've got a 3-day opportunity to change it. We only offer this, however, once. We really don't encourage candidates to keep changing their mind. Some of the centers we have to schedule individually so that they know there's someone there that can proctor the exam. And to keep canceling and rescheduling is very difficult for AMP. There are, if your ADA have any kind of disabilities, accommodations available that we can provide. And one of the best options is to talk to the AMP people to make sure that we can accommodate whatever needs you may have. Next slide. Currently, there are 140 assessment centers in the United States and Canada. We recently had a board meeting at the APIC conference and AMP folks to look into coming up with more assessment centers. And we know they're constantly looking for this. And with a little encouragement, hopefully they'll find some good locations for those of you that may not be conveniently located near a test center. The exam is available in 30 countries, including the United States. So for those of you that aren't in the North American continent, there are sites for you also. And at this time, I'm going to hand it over to Sheila so she can talk to the international issues. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Sharon, and welcome to everyone who's listening in to the teleclass today. I live in Canada, and I know that on these teleclasses there are a number of international candidates, so I thought it might be helpful just to point out a couple of things that are unique when you apply internationally. As Sharon said, the handbook is really a very valuable source of information, and I would encourage everyone to either download it or get a copy and go over it very, very carefully. There's a lot of information in it, and sometimes it's easy to miss something, but look at it very carefully. From the international perspective, all the sites outside the U.S. are considered international. And all the international candidates who wish to write the exam have to apply using paper and pen. You have to mail your application in. You cannot do this online, and I can't stress that enough. At this point in time, you have to do it in the manual fashion, not online. You also can't book your exam date online. The other thing to point out is that there will be a $35 fee, and this is written in the handbook, of course, but you might wonder why those of us who don't live in the U.S. would be charged an extra $35. Well, our testing agency has to cover the additional costs when we look at an international site, and there is a process of getting that examination to the site, linking up with the supervisors, and so on. And all our international sites outside the U.S. are considered special test sites that aren't available always on a day-to-day basis. In the U.S., most of the sites are at H&R blocks. Outside the U.S., they are not. For example, in Canada, most of our sites are at colleges and universities. So there are some fees and additional costs that play into that. So those of us who are international do pay an extra $35. The other idiosyncrasy, perhaps, is that we can't get our mark. When we write the exam, we don't get a pass or a fail immediately, whereas the U.S. candidates do. You will receive your mark in approximately 3 weeks, and I've given myself a wide berth there. It may come, your score may arrive in the mail a lot sooner than that after you write your exam, but it does take a bit of time to process it, and depending on where you live in the world, it may take a bit of time to get it out to you through the mail. So the book says, the handbook says two weeks thereabouts. For some areas, it may be slightly longer than that. So those are a few things that are a little bit idiosyncratic to those of us who do not live in the U.S. Next slide, please. As far as taking the test goes, give yourself plenty of time. Latecomers will be turned away if they are 15 minutes past the time of their appointment. A few other things is that paper is not allowed. Scrap paper will be provided, but it has to be returned at the end of the exam. You can take a calculator into the exam, but it cannot be programmable. You will also be given some time to practice with the mouse and the computer at the test site. Next slide, please. You also have to have your letter and your photo ID with you. Actually, you need two forms of ID, not one. It's two forms. And both have to have your name and your signature on them, and one of them has to have your photograph. So just some things to keep in mind. It's always stressful when you're writing an exam anyway, but just keep in mind the things that you do need to take with you just to relieve the stress of getting there and finding that things are not going according to oil. Okay, and what about the exam? As I said, you will be given time to practice with the computer and the mouse before you actually start your timed examination. The Certification Board also has what we call a practice exam. It is, if you go onto our website, you can find out lots of information about it, and it is available for purchase. The Certification Board has developed this exam. It's really a mirror image of what you will see, or the type of exam you will see when you go into your test center. And it gives you an opportunity to look at the types of questions, to get used to what it looks like on the screen. It will be very, very similar, almost the same, because the same software is used in delivering the actual exam as is used in this practice exam. There are 70 questions on it. Some of them are old questions that have previously been used but are no longer on current exams. So it will give you a sense of what the examination is like as well. So it will give you an idea of what the exam might look like and also some practice with questions. It is $50 and there are 70 questions. You will also get a score at the end. It's developed in accordance with the content areas as are outlined in the handbook. So the questions on that practice exam are fit in under the content areas. So it really gives you a good sense of what it's going to look like when you get into that test center. The questions on the real exam, of course, are going to be different. And Sharon has already addressed the fact that we cannot give you real live examples that are on the exam for obvious reasons. Okay, next slide, please. So taking the test, you do have 3 hours to write the computerized exam. And as Sharon mentioned, the U.S. candidates receive a pass-fail. Those of us who are outside U.S. do not. We will get our mark in the mail, our score, a few weeks later. Next slide, please. Okay, so why would you consider taking the CIC exam? I know some of you probably have it on your mind. You may have been in your positions for maybe 2 or 3 years or longer, and you're thinking, should I or shouldn't I? Or, you know, am I going to pass this, et cetera. So let's look at some of the reasons why somebody might want to take the CIC. We're going to have a whole session on the value of the CIC later on in the year. But just to very briefly address, next slide please, some of the reasons why you should consider it. If you're thinking about it, look at things like recognition and marketability. It may be required for a job application in some areas of North America or elsewhere. A CIC may be preferred on job applications. In other areas, it may be required, or you may be required to write your CIC within a certain number of years of getting your position. In some states, that is actually being legislated. In my own country, it is not. However, some areas of the world are moving to legislating having a CIC after a period of time in the business. Professional development and personal satisfaction, that's probably one of the biggest reasons right now that people take it. Many of us are not recognized in a financial way. But many of us want to, you know, confirm your dedication to infection control, whether you benefit materially or not. So for many of us, it's professional development and personal satisfaction. I mentioned regulation. It may be required. And another reason is that it provides an objective measure of competence to your employer and also to the public. Our public are informed consumers of healthcare. They have access to a lot of information, and they also want their healthcare providers to be the best they can be as well. So it does provide some measure of competence to the employer and to public. Next slide, please. For the next few slides, I'm going to talk a little bit about licensure and competency, and then I will move into actual construction of questions, what makes a good question. I have some examples, too, but I have to tell you they're not on the exam. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about licensure versus competency. Now, when you went through your basic training, whether you are a registered nurse, whether you're a medical laboratory technologist, or whatever, when you went through your basic training, following that training, that period of time, you were required to write an exam, to pass it, and you received a license. And basically, that assures to the public and to your employer that you have the basic competency to practice in your field, that you meet all those requirements. Certification is a little bit different. Certification indicates mastery of a defined body of knowledge, and infection control is a good example of that. Many of us are registered nurses, but we practice in the field of infection control, which is a defined body of knowledge. Or I may be an RN and I work in the oncology area or hematology-oncology area. That is also a defined body of knowledge for which there is certification available. So certification really looks at mastery or knowledge mastery of a very defined body of knowledge. So there's a bit of a difference between licensure and competency. Now, at the certification board, CIBIC does not believe that continuing education credits or CE credits actually measure competency. Competency is a bit difficult to measure, but at the certification board, we do not believe that continuing education credits are enough. And I'm assuming that you've gone on to the next slide. We believe that competency is an ongoing process, and it does require repeat measurement. If you write an exam in a particular field in 1980, does that mean in 2008 that nothing has changed and you are still absolutely, you know, you have the same body of knowledge, you are as expert as you were in 1980? Well, the certification board doesn't believe that attending seminars, workshops, where you don't really have to demonstrate what you acquired, doesn't believe that that is enough. Next slide, please. So competency requires the performance of several related tasks and in concert with knowledge and also some difficulty or cognitive levels of thinking. Next slide, please. So how do we measure competency? What is our exam all about? Well, in our exam, we measure competency by testing or examining your abilities, your skills, your knowledge as much as we can in an examination. This isn't an actual face-to-face, you know, demonstrate for me how you do something. This is an examination. So we measure those skills and abilities that would be expected of an infection control practitioner who could be working in any variety of settings. Okay, it may be long-term care. It may be a community setting. It might be acute care or some other area. Next slide, please. Our certification exam is also validated. I'm sure that many of you are familiar with the AMP, the Applied Measurement Professionals, and our examinations are developed under their guidance. They have test specialists and psychometricians who guide us through this process, and as Sharon mentioned earlier, our CIBIC is also NCCA certified, the National Commission for Certifying Agencies, and it means that we meet the highest national voluntary standard for certification. So we are held accountable and we are held to a very high standard when we are developing our examinations. And our independent testing agency, Applied Measurement Professionals, has a large hand in that. They also oversee the scoring of the exam. The Certification Board does not, of course, do that. All our test items, our questions, are scrutinized to the nth degree and according to the accreditation standards. Each item that we have, exam question, undergoes both expert and statistical scrutiny. And it would be really good if every ICP who is writing our exam could actually sit through one of our examination sessions, because I can tell you it gives you a full idea of what goes into producing this exam. And it is certainly not, you know, a group of questions that are put together and just put out there for use. It is much deeper than that, and it is highly scrutinized, and we have to meet very, very high standards. The testing agency also looks after passing scores, and they make sure that the level of difficulty is equal among our examinations, whether it's the two-year exam or the seven-year practitioner examination. Certification is also, as it says in the slide, it's also acknowledged as an element of an effective infection control program by the Joint Commission in the U.S. Next slide, please. It's very difficult to fully measure competency through an examination, but I'm going to talk a little bit later on about how we get at that. There isn't any way to actually guarantee competence in any field. We can only measure through examination those factors that might indicate competence. Next slide, please. However, we want all our candidates to be able to pass our exam. And we always say, when we're doing these sessions, we always say that there is no intent to trick candidates with questions. That is not our intent, and we work very hard at not doing that with our questions. People often find our questions, sometimes they have quite a few comments about them. But there is no intent to trick the candidates whatsoever. We want people to pass this exam. As you know, there is a practice requirement and a training requirement. Those are fully outlined in the candidate handbook, and I will not go into all of the particulars of the practice and training requirements, but they are requirements before you're able to take the exam. So basically, earning your CIC credential says quite a bit about the practitioner. And again, people want, the public want to know that their healthcare providers are well-trained and they really know what they're doing. And I don't know whether in the next slide you can actually see this, but when we talk about competence, I don't know if you can see it clearly or not, but it just says, I'm the leader, follow me, I've got it sussed, it's this way. And these folks are following this fellow and he's actually going to take them right over the edge of a cliff. So you want competence in your healthcare providers. Okay, next slide, please. So certification and recertification, I alluded to this a little bit before. If you achieved your CIC, say, in 1985, is that sustainable over the course of your career? Things do change. And when you look at the practice of infection control, those of you who have been in it for quite some time, how has it changed in the last 5 years, let alone the last 10 or 15 years or last 20 years? So basically, if you got your CIC way back 15, maybe 20 years ago, does that ensure competence to deal with what you have to deal with today in your work setting? Next slide, please. And we can skip over this because I've already alluded to this, what certification. Just to reiterate, we don't believe that continuing education credits actually demonstrate competence. But the examination is one way that we can actually have an objective measure of reaching or looking towards some type of competence. Next slide, please. So the driving forces, as I alluded to before, there is great public awareness of healthcare-acquired infections. People have access to information today in many, many different areas. And the Internet, of course, is probably the number one for many folks. So our public is informed, they are educated, and they have a higher expectation than perhaps they did 40 years ago. Things have changed a great deal, and they expect our healthcare providers to be competent. If you don't have your CIC, that doesn't mean you are not competent, not at all. However, if you do have it, it's an objective measure that somebody can look at and say, okay, this person passed the certification exam. What does that tell me? Both for the public and your employer. And of course, there's always the emphasis on patient and occupational safety today. And that is also a driving force. Okay, next slide, please. So moving into a little more about the actual exam questions, the type of questions, how we arrive at them, and so on. That's what the last half of this is going to deal with. And just to give you a little bit of background on some of the things that we take into account. So what do we test? We talked a little bit about competency in the last few slides. And again, knowledge alone doesn't necessarily mean that someone is competent to do the job or even will be successful in the job. They may have lots of information under their belt, but it's what they do with that information that really makes a difference. Next slide, please. So what do we test? Do we want people to just memorize things so that they can regurgitate them, so that they can, you know, recognize it and get the answer right? Well, no, we don't want to do that. Our exam goes beyond that. Certainly there are some things that you just need to know. There's straight recall. It's just knowledge that you need to have under your belt, yes, but there's more than that. And if we only had tests that measured one thing, we would end up with not a very sound test and not a good measure of anyone's knowledge or ability to even apply it. So we would end up perhaps with the trivial or something totally irrelevant in our test. Next slide, please. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about cognitive levels to help you understand how we arrive at the questions that we create for the examination. And cognitive levels basically refer to the level of thought or the level of thinking required in order to respond to a test question or what we call an item. And many of you would be, of course, familiar with Bloom's taxonomy, and there are other ways of expressing that. Other folks have also developed taxonomies with slightly different names and so on. Bloom's taxonomy talks about knowledge, comprehension, application, analysis, synthesis, and so on, and evaluation. Others may call it something else, such as declarative, procedural, performance, or whatever. But they're all alluding to levels of thought that would be required as you are writing an examination. So let's look at those cognitive levels because they play into the type of questions that we create. So first of all, there's what we call recall, okay? And that's basically simply retention of knowledge. It primarily tests the recognition or the recall of some very isolated information. It usually refers to very static concepts. The answers won't change, and it doesn't measure your use of knowledge in your job. It does not measure that at all. Next slide, please. So what are some examples of that? Okay, what is the capital of Massachusetts? You either know it or you don't, and it's not likely that that piece of information is going to change over time. It might, but it's not likely. Another example from our world, what are the steps in outbreak management? Again, that static information. The answers aren't going to change, and either you know it or you don't. Is it important for you to know what the steps in outbreak management are? Well, yes, it certainly is. But just knowing those steps doesn't necessarily mean that you know what to do with them or within each of those steps. Next slide, please. So if we ramp it up a little bit, what's an example of the next stage? Well, application is another cognitive level. It's a step above the recall. And basically, it's It's dynamic or variable, and it's really testing application of limited data. There's not a tremendous amount of problem solving required in an application type of question. Some may be required, but not a tremendous amount. And you may be asked to, say, classify or explain or perhaps differentiate something. So you basically have a scenario, and you have given activities under in that scenario, and then you would be asked a question based on that scenario. So that would be an application type question. Okay, next slide, please. For example, a patient is admitted with a post-op wound infection or a surgical site infection. MRSA is cultured from the wound. What type of precautions are required for this patient? This is an application type of question. It's not straight knowledge. Why? Because, first of all, you need to know something about MRSA. Excuse me. And secondly, you need to know something about how it's transmitted and how to prevent that. And you need to know what type of isolation or precautions would be required for this patient. So it goes a little bit beyond recall. You have to put concepts together in order to arrive at the right answer. And there would be four options under this. One of those options would be the correct answer. So that would be an example of an application or procedural type question. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, ramping it up a notch to analysis, okay? And when we go to an analysis type of question, we're getting closer to actually testing the skills and abilities and getting a little closer to testing competence. It's difficult, as I said, to test competence in an exam, but you can get close to it by the type of questions that you ask. So we have recall questions, we have application questions, and if we ramp it up to the third level, it's an analysis question, okay? And basically, in an analysis question, you will be given likely some kind of a scenario. You may be asked to problem solve. You may be asked to interpret some data to arrive at your answer. In other words, you're going to have to fit together a variety of elements in order to answer that question. So it's not just straight recall. I know it or I don't. You're going to have to do some fitting together of information that you have in your head in order to reach the correct answer. Next slide, please. Okay. Now, I created a fictitious question here, and I'm sure there are ICPs out there that would just scream at this. But anyway, this is a fictitious question, okay? It's not on the exam. It's not particularly good question. But anyway, it will give you an idea of what I mean by analysis. An ICP is conducting a best practice quality improvement project in a long-term care unit and is reviewing the occurrence of conjunctivitis over a 4-year period. Okay, and there's some data given to you there, and I don't know whether you can see that on your computers very clearly or not, but basically it gives the number of cases of conjunctivitis in this long-term care unit between 2004 and 2007. Just gives you raw numbers. And in 2004 there were 5 cases, in 2005 there were 4 cases, in 2006 16, and in 2007 there were 12. Okay, so that's the scenario that's being given to you and the data that is presented. Next slide, please. What is the best interpretation of this data? So you're going to have to look at what the scenario is, and you're going to have to look at the data that is being given to you. And we're asking you to fit some things together to arrive at the correct answer. And you've been given 4 options. You have to pick the option that you think is the best interpretation of that data. So that is basically what an analysis question is. Not all of our questions are going to be analysis, obviously. Not all of them are going to be recall, obviously. Not all of them are going to be application. There's going to be a balance. And our psychometricians and the testing agency helps with that to make sure that there is a good balance of the different levels of questions. It would be very difficult to ask analysis questions only on an exam. They're very difficult to write, for one thing. So in this question, we're asking for interpretation. We're giving you information, and we're asking you to fit clues together to say, okay, I know this, this, and this. Out of those four options, which one would I pick? And the answer is A. You've only been given absolute numbers. That is not a good way of presenting data. You need to establish rates, and you need to know. So you need to know a little bit about how to present data. You need to know how to establish rates, and so on. But out of those four options, A is the best interpretation. Now, somebody else might, if we were at the test committee, they would probably rip this apart, this question apart. We scrutinize everything with a fine-tooth comb, and they would probably come up with different options. But this is an example of analysis. Next slide, please. Okay, so just very briefly, what makes a good question? Okay, what kinds of things when we scrutinize, when we're developing questions, what are the things that we try to strive for? And if we don't strive for them, we are held to task for it at our exam committee meetings. Our test specialist is very, very stringent with us. What makes a good question? It should be well constructed. Okay, it should follow normal rules of grammar. It should be clearly stated. Try to avoid negative wording. That distracts the candidate, and it isn't. We try to avoid that if at all possible. Use clear, simple language. Don't put irrelevant things in the question. Are the stem, that's the question itself, and the options, are they grammatically correct? Are they written appropriately from a grammar perspective? Is the stem too long? If you alter it, is it going to alter the actual question? If you shorten it or lengthen it or whatever. Okay, let's consider a question. Okay, I'm going to give you an example. Next slide, please. A patient has been admitted to one of the general medicine nursing units in your hospital. The person is homeless, a known drug abuser, and has been admitted for investigation of a chronic cough and weight loss. A PPD has been ordered. Next slide. The test is administered in the following manner. A, subcutaneous, B, intramuscular, C, intradermal, D, orally. Okay. That is not a particularly well-written question. Why? Okay. What's wrong with it? Well, first of all, do you need all the information in the stem to actually answer the question? And what is the question actually being asked? You've got all sorts of information there about this gentleman that's going to have a TB test. Okay, he's homeless and so on. And definitely it fits into the scenario. But when you only have, you know, you have 3 hours to answer 150 questions, we don't want a lot of extraneous information in the stem. Okay. The question we're getting at is, what's the appropriate administration of a TST, as it is now called, tuberculin skin test? Next slide, please. So, if the test or exam committee got at that question, they would likely revise it to read, what is it that we want the candidate to know? What are we trying to test here? Do they know the appropriate administration route of a TST test? Okay, so we would rephrase it. The appropriate administration route of a TST is subcutaneous, intrathecal, intramuscular, intradermal. Okay, so we've gotten rid of all that extraneous information that wasn't even required in order to answer the question we were trying to get at. So that's a revision of a question that was poorly written. Next slide, please. Okay, so essentially we've tried to give you a little bit about the structure of questions, the actual cognitive levels that we use when we're drawing up these questions. They go through strict scrutiny. They are not thrown together. And we try to make this as strong as possible to test the candidate appropriately. There is one thing that I want to mention in the next slide. I want to mention that there are some helpful things out there that people may think are helpful to help them study. Things like flashcards, study courses, study guides, etc., that you may have come across either on the internet or elsewhere. Basically, we need to make it very clear that CIBIC has no affiliation with the organizations that produce flashcards and study courses and so on. We are not involved in the production of those materials, nor do we endorse them, nor can we speak to the contents or the accuracy of them. So we just need to make it very clear that CIBIC has no part in that. They are available. They are out there, but we do not have any affiliation with them. So I just needed to make that point in case some of you have seen them. Next slide, please. So in summary then, we have reviewed the process of taking the computer exam and some of the process that you need to go through. If you are an international candidate, there are some idiosyncrasies that you need to be aware of. And we've also looked at the structure of questions and how we go about developing the questions to see whether or not the candidate has the skills and abilities that we would expect of an infection control practitioner, either at a 2-year or a 7-year level. So that is the end of the formal presentation, and I would assume that there is opportunity for questions.
Sheila, thank you very much, and Sharon, thank you both. Do you have any other comments before I have my closing comments?
Perhaps the one thing that I would mention that perhaps we didn't mention in the teleclass is the content outline. The questions are structured around the content outline, which is included in the handbook.
Very good. Well, thanks again to everyone for joining this teleclass and to Sheila and Sharon for your effort and your time. Thank you very much indeed. And to all, until we meet again, goodbye.